And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending most of the program today with a composer from Milwaukee by the name of Robert Grady. Robert Grady is actually someone who enjoyed a long and successful career in marketing and advertising, even in the jingle writing business for a time. Upon his retirement 7 years ago, he began work on a musical, the first musical he's ever composed, I'm pretty sure. And it's a work that is going to receive its world premiere this coming weekend. I want to mention right off the bat before I forget that Elizabeth Sparks, who I've had the pleasure of working with at the Racine Theatre Guild on several different productions, including The Little Mermaid, with her in the title role. Elizabeth Sparks is in the cast for this musical. In fact, we're going to hear her in a brief excerpt from the show a little bit later. And it was Elizabeth who told me about this project, how excited she was to be part of it. And so she is a big part of why this conversation is occurring with Robert Grady. Again, this musical called RIP, R-I-P as in rest in peace, RIP, a musical comedy of life and death, will receive its world premiere actually on Wednesday, July 17th and run through July 28th. At Next Act Theater's performance space that is up in Milwaukee, 10 performances in all. And I'm really excited to speak with Robert Grady about the genesis of this work, how the idea first occurred to him even to write a musical, and the story behind this particular musical. And he is responsible, by the way, for both the score and the libretto. Robert Grady, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, thanks, Greg. Glad to be here.
Great. Pull that just a little closer to you.
All right.
And I'm excited to make your acquaintance and hear more about this show. I think we should spend a little bit of time talking about kind of the unconventional story of your life. I mean, not that you've done anything terribly strange or odd, not that I'm aware of anyway, but the fact that you're at this point in your life writing your first musical versus all that you did professionally. And in a sense, my understanding is you're returning to your roots, to some musical roots. So tell us where you're from originally and kind of life's trajectory before we start talking about this specific show.
Sure. Born and raised in the Milwaukee area, went to school as a math major of all things. But hated math, multivariable calculus sort of did me in, and transferred into something I liked, which was music, and the school I went to had a very good music school, so I thrived there and had an opportunity to meet Aaron Copland while I was in school, and that
Wow.
was very exciting. So I became a music major and played in a band like everybody else did back in the 70s when I got out of school. And I started just to make ends meet, tried to write some jingles for some local people up in Milwaukee, and took my jingle reel into an ad agency and said, here, how do you like my jingles? And one of the jingles I actually wrote for the reel was called I Want to Be an Ad Man, and it was my own, it was like a resume.
Huh.
I Want to Be an Ad Man. And so that jingle got me my first job in the advertising business with an agency in Milwaukee. The guy said, hey, I'm going to make you a copywriter. I don't like your music, but I like the words. Who wrote these words? I did. Good, I'm going to make you a copywriter. And I thought he was talking about something legal like copyrights, and I didn't know what a copywriter was. So I said, well, is it a regular job? And he said, $10,000 a year. And I was in hog heaven. I thought that was a lot of money. And so I took my job in the ad agency business and eventually got my MBA. And kind of got away from the music side. I ended up working on McDonald's and Union Carbide and Procter & Gamble and big clients like that for an agency out of Chicago called Leo Burnett. But I was on the account side, meaning I was helping design strategies, long-term strategies, and how to spend your money in media and what kind of research we need to do and all that. I was planning their long-term strategies. I wasn't doing anything in music.
Hmm.
But I missed it, and when I finally broke away from the big agency business and started my own consulting firm, I did have a couple of clients for whom I wrote some radio spots, and I incorporated my own music in it. I had one client who actually had a 50th anniversary, and so I wrote a string quartet because he wanted to have a string quartet for a party for his big 50th anniversary. So I wrote a string quartet. It was about 8 minutes long. It wasn't a big, long piece, but it was fun to hear the quartet play it. I mean, they had a chance about a week to rehearse in advance, and to hear them play it for the first time, that was very exciting.
Wow.
It's not often that I consider myself an amateur composer because I didn't make a career out of it, but it's not often that as an amateur you have an opportunity to hear others play your music back to you. And that's a very exciting opportunity.
Absolutely is. So when you studied music as a music major, mm-hmm. did you study composition?
I did. I was not a lot of people study voice or piano or violin or trombone or something. I was not. I did not have those skill sets. I studied theory and composition. And that was really what I loved. I'd been composing since I was a little kid. My mother always said, you know, she'd come in and hear me playing the piano and say, "What is that?" And I said, "I don't know. I just made it up."
Ah.
That's theme for mom.
Okay, there you go. So
I wrote a lot of those.
So you're a composer at heart and finally getting around to devoting yourself maybe more wholeheartedly to it at this point in your life. By the way, when I introduced you at the outset, I neglected to mention that you've written several books, not about music, but about this professional world that has been so important to you, including one book I know called Naked Marketing, The Bare Essentials. Wonderful title. So about 7 years ago, you tell me, is when you finally retired from this career that had largely taken you far away from music. I'm just curious to hear more about kind of the hunger that drew you back to music after all these years, because there's a whole lot of people that for one reason or another kind of leave music behind and never do find their way back to it.
I had always, I vowed long time ago that at some point I would try and return to music. I wasn't really sure how or what opportunity might arise. I sold my business in 2017 on a 3-year buyout. So I had 3 years to transition into retirement, if you will. The first year I was kind of training the people that were going to be taking over my business. And the second year I started pulling back. And by the third year, they were pretty much running things. So I was sitting at a restaurant in Milwaukee with my friend, also named Greg. And we were just talking. He had retired and I was retired. And we were kind of thinking like, what's next? This fourth quarter of our lives, what are we going to do before we end up having to go to the old folks' home and eventually into the grave? And then we started saying, well, not only what's next, what's after that? You know, once we go to the grave, where do you think we go from there? What's your idea of the hereafter? And so he kind of told me his thoughts, and I told him some of mine. And we sort of said, you know what, we've got kind of an idea here. And so he agreed to be my foil. I'm not sure what I bounce ideas off of him and he bounces them back and says, how about we do this and do that? And so I said, I want to get back to music. And he was an actor. He'd been acting for about 10 or 15 years in various plays, amateur things, sales movies and things like that. So he had a little bit of a background in theater, and I said, between the two of us, we could be dangerous. So, we have just a little bit of knowledge of something. It's enough to make us dangerous. So it all became sort of a snowball thing after that. We started talking about the hereafter and what comes next, and then I said, well, look, I'd like to write some music, and then maybe we'll put the story around the music and figure out what happens from there. And he said, I'll help you the whole way. You write it, but I'll throw, you know, you throw your ideas at me, I'll bounce them back. And so we did that. And we started coming up with the idea of life in a mortuary. And the very first scene, we had this idea of having, well, as it turned out, 5 living and 5 dead characters. And in the opening act, 5 dead people sit up and sing their life stories or their death stories, if you will. And that became the impetus. And that was that's a song called Midnight at the Morgue. And in our first iteration, Greg, that was the name that we gave the the title that we gave the play was Midnight in the Morgue, and it had 16 characters and four or five different themes and a kind of a long involved story. And we got together with some readers, some friends of ours who each took a part, and they all read through it, and we gave them pizza and whatnot, and we said, well, let's have a little party. And they came out of it saying, well, this is a really good idea, but you need to fix this, 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 and this. And these were all people from theater, so they had a good idea of what makes good plays.
Right. And it sounds like, I mean, from what I know of kind of the finished product, it sounds like they gave you some wise advice, which has been given to all kinds of composers over the years, which is, in a sense, keep it simple. I mean, that there's only so much that an audience can take in, and it is probably one of the most common mistakes to create a story that is too complicated for its own good. And it sounds like this was a winnowing away, kind of a focusing.
Right.
And it sounds like you've come up with something that you feel really good about.
Well, that was the first reading. And I say first because we've had multiple. And it's one of the most valuable things you can do, I think, as an author. I've written lots of books, and so I always had someone read a chapter to me, and hearing that voice and the inflection and the way that they interpret my own sentences made me change those sentences so they were clearer and much better. Readers have an awful lot of input themselves as to what, and particularly if they've been in theater, what makes good stories. We had way too many characters. We had children in it, which, unless you're going to do a story about children, having children is murder to work with because of tutors and all sorts of boundaries you have to stay within working with kids. And they only had maybe one or two lines anyway, and it was more like, oh, Mom, that's awful, you know, things like that that were unimportant. So we cut those. The title Midnight at the Morgue didn't work. People thought it was a murder mystery, or maybe it was some sort of a farce. With a name like Midnight at the Morgue, they thought it was a farce. We kept it as the name of the title song because of the lyrics, but we realized we had to come up with a different name. We had way too many themes. We have a racism theme. We had a diversity theme. We had all these different themes that weren't fully developed. In order to do that, we'd have had to have a 4 or 5 hour play. So those readers helped an awful lot. That was the first reading. Once we came out of there, we kind of looked at each other. Greg and I looked at each other and said, well, do we want to keep going? What else we got to do? Yeah, let's keep going. So let's see what happens. So we changed the script around, and then we had we had what's called a staged reading. And that's where we actually had a piano player and a cellist, and the people learned the lyrics to the songs, and so they sang them. They didn't memorize the lines. They would stand on stage, and there was no set. There were no costumes, but that's a staged reading. And we actually had audience for that. The audience gave us feedback. The director and the cast members all gave us feedback, and the musicians told us which songs they liked the best and which ones needed work and that sort of thing. So that second stage reading also gave us an awful lot of input, told us that we needed to have two leads. So we picked out two characters who were sort of central to the story, and they became our leads. We added a song for each one so that they each had their own solo song. And your friend Elizabeth Sparks is one of the has one of the leads. She's been to her audition. She just knocked it out of the park. She's just got a terrific voice. And I'm sure you said you were going to hear an excerpt that you had. That's wonderful. That's great. Because she's got a great voice. And she plays Julia. That's our lead. And her foil, or her counterpart, is Vic. And he is the mortuary attendant. He's the assistant mortuary. Or, I don't know what you would call him, an assistant at the mortuary. And sort of a guy who's down on his luck and has just gone through a divorce and he thinks he has a dead-end job and doesn't really like it very much, but yearns for redemption.
I think one of the things that's intriguing when we read about the show and the characters and the five people who are among the living and then the five who have actually died, and in every single case, pretty much, we're talking about somebody who is living with or having to face significant regret, and or disappointment and or tragedy in their lives. And it's just kind of interesting when you kind of read all those descriptions, it's like, whoa, this sounds so dark and sad. And yet I can just kind of tell from what I've heard from Elizabeth that that's not what it adds up to. It adds up to something actually very, very positive. How would you characterize the way you've managed to do that, to take a lot of characters, all with regret and sadness and so on, and create a musical out of that that is so positive ultimately?
Well, it's an interesting question, Greg. One would think with such a dark subject that yes, you might have it would be very maudlin and sad. We all face death in our lives. First of all, we all are going to die. We all have to recognize that, and we all have that opportunity to make our mark on this planet as a result. But we also face death in a lot of other ways. We have loved ones who will pass on. We've lost our grandparents or our parents, and we've all faced at some point in life this regret that we didn't have more time with that loved one. But what legacy does that loved one leave with us? The fact that we love them and miss them is part of that legacy. And so we begin talking about that person, and we start relating stories. I don't know about you, but after funerals, I sit around thinking about my friend or my family member who has passed on, and I start thinking of all the fun times we had together. Mm-hmm. And a lot of laughter comes out of that, and a lot of joy, and a lot of release of tension, and all of the bad things that happen when we lose someone that we love. Those things seem to be released in that process. And so that's part of what we tap into here is the love that's left behind. That's really our legacy. And we have these five different characters who all have died in very different ways. There's a woman who's died of dementia. There's a fellow who's been shot in a robbery. There's one who's died in a car accident, another of a heart attack, and different ways of dealing with those different. Some of our sudden deaths. One of them is a John Doe, and in his death, he has no idea who he is because he has no ID. He comes into the mortuary with no identification on him, and so he has to deal with his own mortality, obviously. He's dead.
And his anonymity.
And his anonymity. And there's nothing, he makes the point of saying that there's nothing worse than dying in anonymity. We have no legacy to leave behind.
Wow. Wow.
And what kind of redemption? So we eventually, as I was talking earlier, we had way too many themes in the early part of the show. And so what we ended up doing was limiting it to really just two. One is the regrets we have as we near death, or are we facing our own mortality? And the other is the redemption that we receive as a result. And how can we redeem ourselves so that we're worthy of whatever hereafter we're facing?
Hmm. We're speaking with composer Robert Grady about his first musical, which is about to receive its world premiere in Milwaukee. It's called RIP. R.I.P. as in rest in peace, RIP, a musical comedy of life and death. It actually opens a week from today.
That's right.
On Wednesday, July 17th, runs through the 28th at the Next Act Theater Performance Space in Milwaukee. And we should hasten to add, it's kind of interesting, this is at Next Act Theater. It's not part of their official theater, their own theater season, but this is a lovely theatrical venue that is rented out to other companies, and there was a space in their schedule which you have stepped into. Explain to our listeners, although they maybe might guess why the theater was not booked for this particular period.
They had a lot of opportunity to book with the RNC, but it does open during the RNC.
The Republican National Convention.
Right, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And the last 2 days of the convention will be the first 2 days, first two opening days of our show. I actually look at that as an opportunity. I see that as 50,000 more people who could potentially come down to our theater. We're far enough away from the security zone that we don't have to worry about the traffic problems that's going to cause. So I do want to emphasize to your listeners, we're on the south end of downtown Milwaukee. outside the Third Ward, if you're familiar with downtown Milwaukee. We're just in the Walker's Point area on Water Street at the Next Act Theater. So it's easy to get there from the Kenosha Racine markets and that sort of thing. And it's also easy to come in from the west. It might be a little more difficult from the north coming down the freeway, that sort of thing, because of the traffic problems you may run into during the RNC. But the latter half of our show, certainly the second week, will be wide open.
Very good. Let's take a moment to listen to a brief excerpt from one of the songs. And I have to say, this really impresses me. The little bit we get to hear of
Let
this
Let me give you a
song.
Setup on this.
Please, yes.
This is a song. This is Julia, Elizabeth Sparks, singing to her dead sister that I wish I had just one more day. That's the title of the song. I wish I had one more day to see their smiling faces, to give them hugs, to be with them one more time. She has lost her father. He died of cancer recently. Her mother is in hospice, and now her sister's been killed in a car accident. She's lamenting the loss. Well, meanwhile, her sister, who has two children, orphaned now, she's a single mom with two kids, and has no idea what's going to happen to her two children now that she's dead. So she's also lamenting. You'll hear her come in on the latter part of this. I think if this is the excerpt, I think it is. She comes in and says she wants one more day with her kids. So she has a reason to want one more day as well.
Mm. It's a lovely idea for a song, and here is an excerpt from it. So Elizabeth Sparks is one of the singers. And
Taylor Minion
is the other. And here they are, sisters Julia and Emily Huckabee, singing an excerpt from One More Day. Excerpt from the song One More Day. Really lovely. Lovely music, lovely words as well.
I will also emphasize that was only with the piano, not with the full orchestra. And it was early in the rehearsal process because I did notice, having known the song very well
right.
for a long time, I did notice a couple little misnotes. But I know I've heard them recently, and they are terrific. They both have just terrific voices.
Yeah, and they go together very,
very,
very
well.
So I, one of the things that, as I'm hearing the story of this, one of the things that I applaud you for is seeking help, seeking guidance, seeking feedback, because I think a lot of people, when they endeavor to write something, they just kind of blithely assume that whatever ushers from their pen onto the page is just, you know, a beautiful miracle as it is. And you came to this with, in a sense, wide open eyes, knowing that because this was a brand new endeavor, that that probably you were not going to get it perfect the first time out, and you know, really wanted to shape this, improve this, make this as good as it. So I guess what I'm saying is you came to this with a sense of humility that it sounds like ultimately has really served you well.
I did. I was totally ignorant of musical theater. I had never been in this industry before. As a writer of books, you mentioned Naked Marketing. Prentice Hall was the publisher, a big company out of New York, and I worked with them molding the script, if you will, or the manuscript for the book. That taught me an awful lot about the process of manipulating words and putting your best paragraph up front, all those kind of good things. And so that process, I recognized what I didn't know about theater. I was going to need a lot of help. I'm very fortunate in that staged reading I mentioned earlier. The director of that staged reading took an interest in the play. And over time, we had lunch with him. Greg and I had lunch with him, and we talked to him about what do we do next and how do we go about it if we're going to keep doing this. You know, the whole thing kind of snowballed. After that second reading, there was such positive feedback that we thought, well, we can't really give up now. I mean, it's been fun, but let's keep it going and see what happens to it. Well, then his name, that director's name is Alan Petrovich, and Alan decided he wanted to get on board. We asked him, of course, and said, would you help us do this or take it to whatever next step is next? Well, Alan is incredibly talented and knows the theater industry and is very well respected in Milwaukee theater circles. It's kind of a small group of people in Milwaukee in the theater. And he knew most of them, and most of them, more importantly, knew him. And so he brought in really the very creme de la creme of Milwaukee theater to be on our team and to advise us. Many of them advised us not only in script, but also in ways to get it staged. We went and looked at different venues if we were to do some, have it staged. And clearly, Next Act was the best opportunity. It was affordable, and it offered enough capacity that we'd have an opportunity for payback. I'm a businessman, right? So I wanted to make sure that we had our investors all lined up and that they had a reasonable opportunity to make a good return on their investment. And so we scouted around different venues. We came up with Next Act. I remember the day we wrote the check, and the three of us looked at each other and went, all right, this is really happening. Now we're in it for good.
Yeah, this is real. This is real.
Yep.
I'm curious, you had never written a musical before this.
Nope.
Had you gone to musicals? I mean, I'm assuming you had to know what a musical is, but I mean, how much of an aficionado were you of musicals? Had you gone to enough shows that you had at least kind of a rough idea of the ingredients that make for a successful musical?
I come from a musical family. I have older brothers who played the piano and sang. My oldest brother was in lots and lots of musical. He was actually a professional for many years on Broadway. And so I had kind of a background in the family with musicals and that sort of thing. Grew up going to theater with my parents and my brothers, and my little sister is also very talented in music. So music was always around us. Musicals were sort of in our blood, if you will. I was in a play in high school. I think it was South Pacific, and I had a minor role. And I realized right away I couldn't act. So I decided I was never going to become part of theater on that side of things. But I did enjoy being on the back end of things, playing piano for the orchestra or singing as part of the cast or something like that. But I didn't want to be an actor. I never had that bug at all. And also, being as tall as I am, I would have never been able to have a leading lady that didn't look goofy, or I didn't look goofy because of my height. I'm 6'7", so I mean, just to let everyone know. Somebody once said I had a face for radio. Yeah, I've got a body that doesn't really work either. But that was kind of the background that we had. Is our whole family was musical, so I was always interested in the back end of musical, like being part of the music, but not as an actor.
Right. Can you point to one or two shows that you have seen as an audience member or played in the pit or whatever, where you thought this is a great show that might have, at least on a subconscious level, been kind of a guidepost for you?
The pinnacle of musical theater, I think, is West Side Story. I mean, you get Leonard Bernstein writing the music and Sondheim with the script. I mean, you're not going to have anybody better. Choreography, everything in that musical, I think, is probably the pinnacle. The Music Man has always been one of my favorites, and I, Camelot and My Fair Lady and some of the classics. I was always kind of the first musical I ever saw on Broadway was 1776, and it's always remained one of my favorites. It was just on television recently. Of course, it's always on every July 4th.
Sure.
So it was sort of fun to see that again. But I'm more of a traditionalist. I love Andrew Lloyd Webber. I'm going to probably offend all sorts of people, but I didn't care for Hamilton only because I felt it was more opera than theater. There isn't a spoken line in all of Hamilton, and it's all hip hop or ska or some of that sort of stuff. And that's not really my musical style. I'm much more of a classicist.
Sure. Nothing wrong with that. So it has to be incredibly thrilling for you to see this show take shape. Have you been largely a spectator in this staging portion of things?
Well, certainly the director and the cast would prefer it. I have stuck my nose in more than I should, just making comments to the director or something that I might say, you know, that character should be more like this. And he'll look at me and go, Rob, this is like the third rehearsal. Give them a break. They aren't even off book yet. So I'm like, oh, okay, yes, I'll shut up. And he's right. I'm more superlative, superfluous. That's the word. I'm superfluous to the process. At this point, I have to sit back and just say, the actors can change the lines. They can change the vocalizations. The musicians can change the notes if they want. The director himself has changed some of the script in order to make it flow better, or for timing, or something else. Somebody used the example, a director could direct Shakespeare and decide to change the words if he wants to, or she wants to. To be or what? That is the question. You know,
right.
That it could, you know, you can change anything at this point. The script writer or the playwright has very little say.
Right.
A lot of times they're dead.
Sure. So they're sometimes for 400 years.
Yes.
But in this case, Robert Grady, the composer and librettist, is very much alive and well. And
in the way.
Yeah. And I can't. I just can't imagine how exciting this must be for you to see this work you've labored on for 7 years now finally taking shape. So we want to remind everybody that the world premiere performance of Rip, a musical comedy of life and death, takes place 1 week from today on Wednesday, July 17th, with 10 performances in all running through Sunday, July 28th. The performances will be at Next Act Theaters, a performance space that's at 255 South Water Street. And if you can find a website devoted to Rip, a musical comedy. If you Google that, you can find that website very easily. You can also find the website for Next Act Theater, and that's also a means to purchase tickets to come and experience this brand new musical as it makes its way onto the stage for the very first time. Robert Grady, responsible for both the score and libretto and original story for Rip, a musical comedy of life and death. Robert Grady, it's been great to make your acquaintance, and it's been a fun experience to explore this story, and we hope that a lot of people take advantage of the opportunity to experience your musical, and I hope that you'll be doing something like this again. Do you see the possibility of a second show?
My wife tells me no, this is way too much work. But like I say, it's like a snowball going downhill. I don't know what's going to happen next.
Right.
Part of it is, hey, if it's a big hit or something, maybe it'll take us someplace else. We don't know.
Sure.
We're just looking at it as being an opportunity now.
Well, enjoy this right now, then. Rip, a musical comedy of life and death. Robert Grady, congratulations, and thanks for being part of the morning show today. It was great to have you here.
Greg, thank you very much.
And now part two of today's morning show here on WGTD on a related topic. The book we have before us for this portion of the morning show is called The Conversation. And I love the title of this book, and I love the book itself because it addresses something that can be exquisitely difficult and yet so incredibly important. The conversation that we need to have with our loved ones about the end of life. And it's not a conversation, as our author points out, so much about death and about dying as it is about living and about trying to safeguard the quality of a loved one's life right up to the end of life. Unfortunately, in many, many cases, all kinds of decisions get made, sometimes rather inadvertently, which in fact very seriously undermine the quality of one's life as one suffers through, for instance, a terminal illness of one kind or another. And if no conversation has ever taken place about what that loved one's wishes in fact are, about what sort of interventions or measures they would want to have taken, if no such conversation has taken place, then by default, all kinds of sort of shop-worn practices come into play almost automatically. And it can be an absolutely tragic scenario and a needlessly tragic scenario. I am so happy about this book, which has been written, that addresses the need to have such a conversation with one's loved ones. The author is a physician himself, Dr. Angelo Volandis. He is a researcher at Harvard Medical School and co-founder of Advanced Care Planning Decision, which is a nonprofit organization that really devotes itself to encouraging these kind of conversations. And this lovely new book is published by Bloomsbury. And Dr. Angelo Volandis, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And I do congratulate you on a marvelous job with this book. And we should mention, I wish we were on television or in some way this was visual so I could just hold up the book. It's not a formidable book in terms of length. And I think it's a mistake to present somebody with a 500-page book that no one in the right mind would sort of feel equal to reading on a topic like this. It's a modest-sized book and yet packed with all kinds of really fine observations. One of the primary formats is that it is sort of built upon the experiences of seven seriously ill patients, each of whose story is a bit different, and yet each sort of plays into this very same issue. Talk for a moment about your decision to create the book in this way, and to what extent it was maybe a matter of difficulty in terms of evoking the real life experiences of actual patients.
Absolutely. So the book consists of seven patients that I've personally cared for, and I detail their end of life experience, which hinged on whether or not they had a discussion with either their providers or their families about what was important to them. So I talk about good cases, but also bad cases of times when patients received medical care that if they were more informed about, they probably would never have wanted. You know, whether it's a patient with advanced Alzheimer's disease, a grandmother who never told her daughters or her grandchildren what was important to her, about what sort of things she would and would not want if she were no longer able to communicate with them, but also about cases where patients actually start the process of asking those important questions and telling their loved ones what's important to them. So it's part memoir, but it's also part how-to. So towards the end of the book, I actually give people a how-to on how they can protect themselves from a healthcare system that has been designed to do everything. And you're absolutely right. It was written in a conversational style and in a way that I like to say, if I gave this to my parents, they would love to read it. Not too short, not too long, just enough to talk about what I consider one of the most important conversations in our life.
One line jumps out at me in particular, or haunts me, I guess I should say. This is in the introduction of the book. So you write this: the conversation stems from my belief that one toxic side effect of the extraordinary progress that has been made in medical technology is the assault of medical interventions at the very end of life. I don't think I've ever heard that more persuasively phrased, that idea that medical interventions can be an assault in a way. And of course, at the time, in the moment, those administering them and the loved ones sort of green lighting them probably that's the last thing they would think of. And yet, I think enough of us know enough about this to realize that, in fact, that's probably a very appropriate way to think about it.
Absolutely. You know, we live in one of the most expensive healthcare systems in the world where extraordinary things are possible, but we also live in a healthcare system that has some of the worst deaths in the entire world. We've designed a healthcare system where the assumption is do everything. And so doctors are put in a very uncomfortable situation. We assume that the patient wants everything done unless someone tells us to stop. And in a system where we don't have conversations, where we don't ask patients what's important to them, that means we do these a blitz of medical interventions that if you actually just asked people, would you want some of these interventions in an advanced illness, most people tell us no, but we just don't stop and slow down and have those very difficult conversations. And so, yes, I do think that it's one of the worst side effects of modern medicine is this assault of these aggressive interventions that often have very little benefit in patients with a serious illness.
Right. I appreciate the fact that your book seems written for both ordinary people who find themselves maybe caught up in unfortunate situations and play a role in all this, but my sense is that this book is also written for doctors to read and as a way for doctors to rethink some of their own practices, some of their own attitudes. For one thing, at one point you say doctors like to tackle problems and fix them. And it is truly amazing what modern medicine has achieved in a relatively brief span of time. And you go on to mention several different issues in which now there are interventions that can make a real difference. Then you say the tougher issue, however, is when to recognize that the small fixes do not change the larger picture, or to recognize that fixing specific problems may not fix the whole patient. I've never really stopped to think about that, but I suspect that's really, really true, that it's only human for a doctor to go after every problem that seems fixable, and the typical loved one wants that to happen as well. And yet there can be a very serious consequence if that approach is followed sort of unthinkingly or past the point where it really makes sense for the overall well-being of the patient in question.
Absolutely. Look, we train our doctors for about 10 years, 4 years of medical school and then many years of residency training and fellowship training. And what are we training them to do? Interventions, to learn chemistry, organic chemistry, biochemistry, to learn to be proficient at these technical skills. But we don't train them to be master communicators. We don't train them to reflect on when to use or not to use these skills that we're teaching them. You know, one of the amazing things that I've experienced over the last month since the book's been out are these emails from doctors saying, who have read the book and tell me, wow, you know, I just haven't thought of it like that. I haven't stopped. I've just been doing things because that's what we were taught to do. You know, by the time I finished residency, I was quizzed and tested on whether I can do about five to 10 different procedures, CPR, lumbar punctures, paracenteses. But no one ever asked me, can you actually talk to a patient? Can you talk to someone about care at the end of life? And so we're training our physicians to be technicians. It's time that we train them to be humanistic doctors. It's not surprising that we have this healthcare system where people are not honored and respected at the end of life when we're producing technicians. It's time that we produced more holistic doctors, doctors who actually care to listen and hear the patient's story.
One of the things you point out is that in so many cases, when a patient is admitted to a hospital, they are cared for by hospitalists, and that's what you are. And you are obviously a very caring doctor, but by and large, you are caring for patients that in it, probably most cases are complete strangers to you. Unlike, for instance, the relationship they might have with their primary care physician, perhaps who has been with them for years, maybe decades. And I suppose that underscores the importance of having conversations with patients, because otherwise you don't know anything about who they are, the life they have lived, and what they might want as their life comes to a close.
You're absolutely right. I am a complete stranger to the vast majority of patients that I admit to the hospital. They've never seen me, and I have never seen them. So it is a really tough conversation when all of a sudden we have to talk about, if you're critically ill, about what's important to you. And if no one, if your primary care provider or if your oncologist, your specialist, has never started this conversation with you, then you're hearing these questions for the first time. You know, hospitalists now account for the overwhelming majority of healthcare delivered in our hospitals. Almost every metropolitan area in America is taken care of in the hospital system. Patients are taken care of by hospitalists. So this is an urgent issue, and I hope that by the time people read the end of the book, that they're outraged. I hope that's the feeling people have. It's outrageous that we allow so much of this end-of-life care to happen in our country, but this is the reality, and so people need to take back their health care. And as part of the book, we have a YouTube video that people can help empower themselves. It's 5 minutes long. It goes over the questions you need to ask yourself and what your medical options are. It's at theconversationbook.org. Hmm.
And what's important for us to also acknowledge is that, in a sense, we're talking about at least two different conversations that are really important and that tend not to happen enough. One is the importance of conversation between doctor and patient, and of course, conversations that need to happen even before that situation arises, conversations amongst loved ones, particularly conversations preferably without a looming crisis in the midst. Conversations, frank and honest and loving conversations about these really important matters.
Absolutely. People should be having these conversations when they're feeling great, when they're surrounded by their loved ones at the Thanksgiving dinner or at a Sunday dinner. We should not be having these conversations when you're critically ill, it's 3 a.m, you're in the emergency room vomiting, and this is the first time that someone's asking you what's important to you and what your hopes and fears are about medical care. You know, one thing I tell people is go ahead and start this process at home with your loved one, and then go ahead and use your iPad, your tablet, or your iPhone and record the conversation and email it to everyone, your doctor, your healthcare system. You know, one day in the future, we'll be able to upload these videos, but at least you're not just filling out some paper document that to a physician might not mean a lot, because I don't know if you understood what you were filling out. But if I see a video and I hear your voice, it's really helpful to me to understand who you are, especially when you're critically ill.
Hmm. We're talking about a book called The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care, written by Dr. Angelo E. Volandis. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we are previewing for you this year's Secret Garden Walk, sponsored by the Four Seasons Garden Club at Kenosha. Linda Guy will be joining us to talk about this year's Secret Garden Walk, and joining her will be TJ Levesque, who is Executive Director of Hawthorne Hollow. Hawthorne Hollow is actually this year's bonus garden on the Secret Garden Walk, and TJ Levesque's own home garden is actually one of the home gardens that is also part of this year's self-guided tour. So we'll be talking all about that on tomorrow's morning show, and I hope you'll make a special point of listening. By the way, tickets are on sale right now at various florists around town, or you can purchase a ticket on Saturday during the walk, which is between 9 and 3, but it is cheaper if you buy your tickets ahead of time. And on Friday, Nick Dembski from the Racine Public Library. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. And don't forget about the morning show podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Cloudy skies today and a high of 76 degrees. We'll have an overnight low of 62 degrees, and looks like we should have sunshine both tomorrow and Friday with daytime highs in the low 80s, warmer over the weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.